Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear it. Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January 30th, 2011, and this is the third installment of the Operation Barbarossa series, and William Fink and Kaiser are joining us. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Hello, hi. Praise Yahweh. Kaiser's too nice a guy. He always lets me go first. I don't want to go first.
I know, Bill. I try to let you go. Praise Yahweh. Good evening, gentlemen.
And just to briefly recap, we've already demonstrated in the last two shows that the Soviet Army had hundreds of thousands of soldiers immediately on the border with Germany. Indeed, over 1.5 million soldiers, and that's just a very generously low estimate. They had another 1.5 million deployed about 100 miles from the border. They were all in offensive positions. They had really no defensive fortifications. They were readying to launch a juggernaut of an assault into Central Europe. And when the Germans attacked, it was basically a preemptive attack, and they caught them off guard. That's why the Germans were so successful, because the Soviets were all deployed in forward staging areas to jump off for an offensive. They weren't ready to defend. They were ready to attack, and the Germans headed off that attack with their assault, Operation Barbarossa. We've demonstrated that. Would you gentlemen agree that there's absolutely no doubt that the Soviets were planning a huge offensive into Central Europe in 1941, 42 at the latest?
Well, absolutely. And Suvorov, I think last week we showed from Viktor Suvorov, the Russian historian, that Stalin even knew the date by which that war had to start, because of the way he passed the draft, and it was a 2-year compulsory draft of all the men in that prime age slot, in 3 age slots, 18, 19, and 20. He drafted them all, and it was a 2-year period. He had 2 years to train them, and he would have had to let them go if he did not start the war by the particular date, which he did.
Absolutely. In Hitler's speech from October 3rd, 1941, shall I just resume where we left off then, or are there any more comments about what we've covered already?
No, I'm good.
All right. The progress of this unparalleled event is known to you in outline. Of the three German army groups, one had the task to break open the center and to open up the way to the right and the left. Two flanking groups had the task, one to advance against Leningrad and the other to occupy the Ukraine. These first tasks have been substantially achieved. And I just want to point out that Army Group North was basically going to advance to the Baltic states and take Leningrad in conjunction with the Finns, although the Finns stopped as soon as they retook the territory that they'd lost to the Soviet Union, since the Finns were not looking to aggressively advance into the Soviet Union. That's just more evidence that Finland was never a threat to the Soviet Union, let alone an existential threat, as Molotov asserted. He would have us believe, or he would have had Hitler believe, that the Finns were going to destroy the entire Soviet Union. That's absolutely ridiculous and absurd, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
The idea that
they didn't have any tanks until they captured some from the previous war.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hitler really grieved about the Soviet assault on Finland, because he didn't want to let it happen. But he already had the non-aggression pact signed with the Soviet Union, and he's a man of his word, and he was stuck.
And I wanted to say that Germany had to supply Finland with tanks for the most part later in the war, of course. Once the war with the Soviet Union broke out, Finland got most of their tanks from Germany. They didn't have some massive army. I think that the Finns had 1/10 of the soldiers that the Soviets brought against them in the Winter War. So the idea that Finland was getting ready to destroy the Soviet Union, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, it's absolutely ludicrous. I mean, that's like saying that the Bahamas are ready to attack America.
Well, it seems like we should invade then. We should head it off. or there'll be Bahamian tanks rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue. They've already got a Bahamian in the president as the president, though.
Well, right. It was absolutely a pretense, and I think that Stalin understood his position in the I'm going to be pretentious and say that I think he understood his position with the House of Rothschild in England. He definitely understood his position with Franklin Roosevelt, who absolutely fawned over him. He knew that he could get that off and have very little trouble from the media and from the other leading powers in the world.
And I just wanted to point out, too, about Army Group South that advanced from Romania and Hungary and Czechoslovakia into the Ukraine and the southwestern Soviet Union. The fact that they had so much help from the Romanians, the Slovaks, the Czechs, the Hungarians, etc., that shows that Europe recognized the Soviet Union as an existential threat to the very existence of European civilization, or else they wouldn't have mustered and joined forces with the Germans.
Well, they absolutely knew that Stalin had been threatening to subsume all of Europe. That was not a vain threat. That was an actual Soviet plan to have Soviet SSRs. And we read that last week, meeting to have world congresses of Soviet SSRs meeting in Russia from all over the world. That wasn't a joke. It was the Russian Jews that wanted to take over the entire world. It wasn't Adolf Hitler.
Well, they always attribute this, today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world. But what speech did Hitler say then, and they can't tell us?
Well, that was all Jewish propaganda so that they could take over the world.
And they've done that.
Yes, they have.
All right.
There's a Jewish-run central bank running just about every nation on the planet. The only countries that don't have Jewish-run central banks are consistently threatened with warfare by the Jewish media and by the neocons in America, Libya, Iraq,
well, Iraq
Iran.
Has been
well, now they have a Jewish-controlled central bank, yes.
And I have heard that Iran actually does have a Rothschild-run central bank. I've heard that. I don't know if that's valid or not.
Well, I would be surprised, and I never heard it before, and I always thought they didn't. But it's basically contrary to Muslim law, and they come up with intricate banking schemes so that they don't have the appearance of
usury.
Collecting usury.
They have interest fees and generation fees and whatnot, or loan fees, I think is what they call it.
Right.
I don't really know how Islamic banking works, but I'm sure it's pharisaical.
Yes, absolutely. It's also another pretense.
Oh, as of 2006, by the way, the five nations that did not have a Rothschild central bank, and this was as of 2006, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, and Libya. It sounds like the axis of evil.
Well, that is the axis of evil.
So
and now we really know why.
If you don't want the Jews to control your country, you're evil.
And you'll be besieged with warfare forever.
During this time of great historical fighting, the enemy is asking, why is nothing happening? But something had always been happening. But because something was happening, we could not talk. If I were the British Prime Minister today, I would probably keep talking in the circumstances because there is nothing happening there, and that is the difference. We could not because we did not pay homage to the everlasting achievements of our soldiers, but because we could not give any information to the enemy in advance of situations of which he, with his miserable news service, became aware only days or even weeks later. A German high command communique is the report of truth, even if some stupid British newspaper lout declares it must first be confirmed. German high command communiques have been thoroughly confirmed. We have defeated the Poles and not the Poles us, although the British press has been saying the opposite. There is no doubt that we are in Norway and not the British. Nor is there any doubt we were successful in the Netherlands and Belgium and not the English. There is also no doubt that Germany has conquered France and that we are in Greece and not the English or the New Zealanders. Nor are they in Crete, but we are there. Thus, the German high command spoke the truth. It is not different in the East. According to the British version, we have for 3 months suffered one defeat after another, yet we are 1,000 kilometers beyond our frontier. We are east of Smolensk. We are before Leningrad, and we are on the Black Sea. We are before the Crimea, and the Russians are not on the Rhine. If therefore the Russians have been continuously victorious, they did not make use of their victories. Indeed, after every victory, they marched back 100 to 200 kilometers, evidently to lure us deeper into their area. And incidentally, they would have been on the Rhine had it not been for Operation Barbarossa. They'd have been at the English Channel. Then what would the British media be reporting? Stalin has liberated Europe.
Absolutely. Stalin has liberated Europe is exactly what they would have been reporting, right?
The magnitude of this battle is shown by the following figures. There are many among you who have experienced the World War, and they know what it means to take prisoners and to advance hundreds of kilometers. The number of prisoners has now risen to roughly 2.5 million Russians. The number of captured and destroyed guns in our hands is approximately 22,000. The number of captured or destroyed tanks in our hands is over 18,000. For destroyed or shot down airplanes, it is over 14,500. Behind our front lines is a Russian area twice as large as the German Reich when I took over leadership in 1933, or four times as large as England. The beeline covered by the German soldiers is over 800 to 1,000 kilometers. The marching distance is often 1.5 times or greater. They are fighting on a front of gigantic lengths and against an enemy who, I must say, does not consist of human beings but of animals or beasts. We have seen now what Bolshevism can make of human beings. We cannot bring to the people at home the pictures we have at our disposal. They are the most sinister that human brains can imagine. The enemy is fighting with a bestial lust of blood on one hand and out of cowardice and fear of his commissars on the other hand. And I think in Russia number one, we showed exactly what those sinister Jews can do.
Well, absolutely. They did the first they imported millions of beasts from Mongolia and from the eastern provinces, right? That they selected various peoples from Eastern Europe who they knew would be hostile against the Slavic Russians, like the Lithuanians, the Letts, to oppress the Russian people, and they were experts at doing what old Rome itself did, pitting ethnic group against ethnic group. And using starvation to force people into their will.
Absolutely.
And that would create animals out of men. The Bible warns us about it all the time.
Well, they can't get people to willingly adopt Bolshevism. They have to force it on the gunpoint.
No doubt.
Our soldiers have come to know the land after 25 years of Bolshevist rule. Those who went there and in their hearts or bodies have something of a communistic outlook in the narrowest sense of the term, have returned cured of this idea. It seems that all these idealists, these progressives, they think communism is going to be so great until real communism comes along. Then they don't think communism is going to be great anymore. Generally, they don't think much anymore because the communists purged them. The pictures of this paradise of workers and peasants, as I've always described it, will be confirmed by 5 or 6 million soldiers after the end of this war. They will be witness upon whom I can call. They have marched to the streets of this paradise. It is a single armaments factory against Europe at the expense of the standard of living of the people. Our soldiers have won victories against this cruel, bestial opponent, against this opponent with the mighty armaments. I cannot think of a phrase that would do justice to them. What they are continually achieving in bravery, courage, and immeasurable efforts cannot be imagined. Whether we take our airmen, our fighters, our dive bombers, our Navy crews, which man our U-boats, whether we finally take our Alpine troops in the north, or whether we take the men of the SS detachments, they are all alike. But above all, and I would like to emphasize this especially now, stand the achievements of the German infantrymen. We have three divisions, my friends, which since spring have marched from 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers. This includes numerous divisions which have covered 1,500 or 2,000 kilometers. This speaks for itself. And I believe it should have been translated, we have three army groups, since the army groups would include the divisions. Continuing the speech, though, I can say that if one speaks of lightning war, then these soldiers deserve to have their deeds described as lightning, for such performances and marches forward have never been surpassed in history except by headlong flights of some English regiments. And of course, he's referring to retreats, talking about how fast the British are to run away. There are only some historic precipitated retreats which have surpassed these performances. In any case, there was no question of such long distances, for the enemy took care to keep near to the coast. I do not mean thereby to disparage the enemy. I only want to render to the German soldier the justice he deserves. He has achieved the unsurpassable. All organizations associated with him are partly workers, but also partly soldiers. For in this mighty space, almost everybody is a soldier today. Every worker is a soldier. Every railway man is a soldier. In the whole of this area, everybody must build with weapons, and it is a colossal area. What was achieved behind this front is just as grandiose as the achievements at the front. Over 25,000 kilometers of Russian railways are again functioning. Over 15,000 kilometers of Russian railways have been converted to the German gauge. In the east, the length of the line which today has been converted into the German gauge is more than 15 times as great as what used to be the longest trunk line in the Reich, that from Stettin to the Bavarian Alps, and Stettin being on the Baltic Sea, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, which is just short of 1,000 kilometers. What this has cost in sweat and effort, even the people at home may not appraise. And behind all this, there are the labor battalions and labor services of our organization. The whole gigantic front of these services and of the Red Cross, medical officers, stretcher bearers, and Red Cross nurses, all of whom are making sacrifices. Behind this front, a new administration is already being built to look after the whole of this colossal area. If this war lasts much longer, Germany and her allies will make use of it, and its usefulness will be tremendous, for there is no doubt that we know how to organize it. If I give you now, in a few sentences, a picture of the unique achievements of the German soldiers and of all those who are today fighting or working in the East, I would also convey to you the gratitude of our soldiers for the excellent first-class weapons the country has supplied to them, and their gratitude for the munitions that are at their disposal in unlimited quantities as fast as they can be transported. Well, of course, there's no munitions strike like in 1917 or 1918, is there, since the Jews have been thrown out? There is only
Right, exactly. Like Hitler blamed the Jews for pulling, and rightfully so, during World War One, they organized munition strikes in Germany. It cost Germany the war, a war where Germany never lost a battle on her own soil.
Absolutely. There is only the problem of transportation. We have seen to it that in the midst of this huge war of materiel, the function of production has been organized in a larger area. For I know that there is now no adversary who cannot be forced to yield by an available mass of munitions. And if at times you read in the newspapers about the huge plans of other states of what they intend to do and to begin, and when you hear of some runnings into billions, remember, I now say, first, we place the whole continent in the service of this struggle. Second, we do not talk of capital, but of labor, and we place this labor 100% in this service. If we do not talk about it, this does not mean that we are not doing anything. I know perfectly well that the others are doing everything better than we do. They are building tanks that are invincible, that are faster than ours, and do not need any gasoline. In the fighting, we have everywhere put many of them out of action. That is decisive. They build wonder planes. Everything they do is amazing. All they do is incomprehensible, even technically incomprehensible. But they have no machines that can surpass ours, and the machines we drive or fly today, or with which we shoot today, are not the machines we shall drive, fly, or shoot with next year. I believe that will satisfy every German. Everything else will be seen to you, will be seen to by our inventors and by our German workers and working women. Behind this front of sacrifice and bravery in the face of death, there is also the home front, a front formed by city and country. And of course, this home front is productive since, as you said, there are no Jews around to organize a counter-war movement and destroy the German war effort. Imagine trying to wage a war while the home front is dominated by Jews.
Well, right, and if we read the Pataki reports next, we'll find that that's exactly why the war started, because Hitler wanted to expel the Jews.
And when he's talking about what other countries say they're doing, I have to imagine he's referring primarily to America, since at this time Roosevelt was having peacetime drafts saying we're going to spend tens of billions on ships and planes and tanks, this whole arsenal of democracy nonsense. I imagine he's referring directly to FDR in the U.S., wouldn't you think?
Well, right, but FDR in the U.S. were already aiding the Soviets to a great degree.
Millions of German working men are laboring in the cities and in the country. An entire people is engaged in this struggle. This united German people was confronted by two extremes in the world outside. In one, the capitalist state denies the natural right to their people through lies and treachery, and in which they keep solely their own vested interest. On the other side stood the communist extreme, a state that has brought inconceivable misery to millions and desires to bring the same misery to the entire world. And they've stated as much in the Communist Manifesto, Das Kapital, and all of their writings. They've explicitly said that the entire world will be the Soviet Union.
Well, absolutely, and they failed to do that. But the West, moving towards communism peacefully, they didn't have to. They accomplished their plan without having the Soviet Union conquer the world.
Absolutely, but even in their song, they said that the Internationale shall be the human race, and it seems that today the International Soviet is indeed. We have one international system.
Absolutely, and they move us more and more into a position that's more and more unified with that each year. Every session of Congress moves closer to it, and people just won't see it.
In my opinion, this imposes upon us only one duty, to strive more than ever after our national socialist ideals. For we must be clear on one point. When this war is concluded, it is the German soldiers who will have won it. The German soldier who has come from the peasants and the factories, who really represents the masses of the people. It will have been won by the German home front with millions of men and women, workers and peasants, the creative men in the offices and in the professions. All these millions of active people will have won it. Those who labor at home have the right to know that this new state will be built for them. The experiences of the front will produce still more fanatic National Socialists. In Germany, the system of justice reigns. He who had been able to lead, whether in the military, political, or economic field, will be equally valuable and equally esteemed in Germany, but just so highly esteemed will be he who put out help, without whose assistance this greatest leadership would not be capable of anything. That is decisive. The German people can be proud today. They have the best political leaders, the best generalissimos, the best engineers and economic organizers, and also the best working men, the best peasants, and the best people. To weld all these people into one indissoluble community was the task we set ourselves at as National Socialists. This task confronts Germany more today than ever before.
And Hitler couldn't, he knew in Mein Kampf, he expressed over and over again the idea that there was no way he was going to weld these people into one indissoluble community unless they were all Germans.
Well, you can't make a Jew a German.
No, you can't make a Jew a German. And that's why Hitler despised Austria, because he understood that Austria could never really stand because of its Slavic and German populations, and that the two populations really couldn't thrive together, that the advantage, one population was always going to be favored to the disadvantage of the other.
And not just the Slavs, but of course they had the Romanians, the Hungarians, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Poles. You know, of course there were Slavs.
Well, right, but most of those people are ethnically Slavic.
And they had Jews. Sorry, go on.
I wouldn't speak for all of the Romanians, but most of those people are ethnically Slavic.
I don't know if the Hungarians would identify as Slavs, though.
No, the Magyars are another story, right?
And it seems that the Austrian-Hungarians, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, their idea was we're going to turn Jews into Austrians, we're going to turn Slavs into Austrians, and that's just silly.
Well, right. It was a melting pot, and the melting pot never works. In the Book of Daniel, we see that the iron cannot cleave to the clay. It's not possible.
In the end, the melting pot exploded.
Every empire in world history has gone down in flames and melted into the lowest elements of the melting pot, of the original components.
Well, when you put impure base metals with steel, you don't get higher quality steel.
Well, of course not. And that's why Egypt was the greatest of nations, and look at it today. And Persia was the greatest of nations, and look at it today. Now they're just beasts.
I shall emerge from this war one day again with my party program, the fulfillment of which is more important to me today than during those first days. I have come here to tell the German people that in the winter help scheme, it has the opportunity to show community spirit. What sacrifices those at the front are bearing cannot be made up by anything. What the German home front has achieved and will still achieve will stand before history. Only when the entire German people become a single community of sacrifice can we expect and hope that Almighty God will help us. The Almighty has never helped a lazy man. He does not help the coward. He does not help a people that cannot help itself. The principle applies here. Help yourselves, and Almighty God will not deny you his assistance. How many times did Stalin talk about God in any of his speeches, unless he was saying God is dead or God is foolish? Do we even have a record of a Stalin discussion? You said that Stalin never had the meetings, his party meetings recorded. The minutes of his meetings were not taken down because he was basically a gangster and he knew it. Can you hear me, Bill?
I'm sorry. I muted my microphone and didn't realize I did that. Well, right. Stalin operated just like a mafia don, and even Suvorov professed that, and the description that Suvorov gave of Stalin's method of operation was certainly just like we'd see in The Godfather, in a Hollywood movie about the mafia.
He didn't conduct himself like a legitimate head of state who would want to record his meetings for posterity.
No, he conducted himself just like he started out in his career. He conducted himself like somebody planning a great heist or a train robbery. And he carried that method of operation right into the government of the entire empire along with him.
He was planning a heist against Europe.
Yes, he was. Okay, I'd like to back up. That was the Adolf Hitler speech at the Sports Palace on the opening night of the War Winter Relief Effort, October 3rd, 1941.
Yes.
I would like to, just so that people know what we just finished, right? I would like to go back up to these the Pataki reports. And I think these are important because these show the American perfidy. And I don't know, to me they somewhat reveal that the Americans had to be acting in concert with the Soviet Union, that it was the Jewish plan to destroy Nazi Germany, and that this maneuvering of Nazi Germany into a position where it would be destroyed, what was actually a long political chess game. And there's no doubt in my mind from what we've just read and from what we read in Suvorov last week. So I think that that the Pataki reports are enlightening, and perhaps next week we can continue with more of the military aspect of Operation Barbarossa, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to read the Pataki reports. This ran in the Barnes Review in 1997. This is from Gregory Douglas. After the collapse of the Polish government and the occupation of the capital in Warsaw in September and October of 1939, the Germans located the secret archives of the Polish Foreign Ministry hidden in a bunker. A number of the documents were hastily translated and published by the German government as a white book in 1940. The Polish ambassador to the United States, and I have several of those German white books in my possession, and Municher has helped me with those, and I'll be using them as future presentations here on this program, and they're pretty good material. The Polish ambassador to the United States, Count Jerzy Pataki, scion of a famous Polish family, wrote a number of important reports to the Polish foreign minister that gave a very clear picture of an educated European's view of American politics and the forces that shaped U.S. foreign policy. One of these reports dealing with the Jewish influence on President Franklin Roosevelt was reprinted in part by General J.F.C. Fuller in his landmark historical work, a military history of the Western world. So that basically, that bit of knowledge gives us providence for these Pataki reports. They're more or less, that they're legitimate, right? And the general cites this report as having significant bearing on the activities of those who had a great hatred of Germany and Hitler, and who also had immediate and significant access to Roosevelt. The second report under discussion here was also in the Polish Foreign Office files, but because it discussed opposition to Hitler, was never included in the German White Paper, because it reveals very clearly the reasons why Roosevelt hated Hitler and the Germans and intended to force American intervention against him. It is included here. The first report was written by Count Pataki on January 12, 1939. To the foreign minister in Warsaw, public opinion in America nowadays expresses itself in an increasing hatred of fascism. Well, isn't that connected to the Jewish media campaign against fascism?
Well, I guess the people just woke up and decided, hey, for no reason at all, let's hate Hitler.
And most people of that time, most of the common people, I'm sure, could not define fascism.
Most people today can't define fascism.
Exactly. Chancellor Hitler and everything connected with National Socialism. Above all, propaganda here is entirely in the hands of the Jews, who control almost 100% of the radio, the films, and the daily and periodical press, the newspapers and magazines. Although this propaganda is extremely coarse and is designed to present Germany as blackly as possible, when bearing American public ignorance in mind, their propaganda is so effective that people here have no real knowledge of the true state of affairs in Europe. This should be very believable, because we see it around us in daily life all over America today.
People think that Iran today is going to destroy the world with all of their nuclear weapons.
Well, Iran is the new Germany, isn't it? You think it has anything to do with Iran not having a central bank? At the present time, most Americans are taught to believe that Chancellor Hitler and National Socialism are the greatest evil and the greatest peril threatening the world. I'm sorry, Iran was in your list, right? Or am I mistaken about that?
Iran, Libya, Sudan, Cuba, and North Korea.
Okay, thank you. Well, in 1933, guess who else didn't have a central bank? A Jewish-controlled central bank. Yeah, that's a good guess.
I might have said the United States, but it's clear that we've had one for a long time.
The situation here provides an excellent program for public speakers of all kinds, among whom are many refugees from Germany and Czechoslovakia, who with much effort and many patently false accounts incite the American public. These speakers praise American liberty, which they repeatedly contrast with totalitarian states. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Hitler was elected up to 1938 democratically, right?
Well, they say those were all fraudulent elections, and our elections where dead people vote every year is somehow the pinnacle of democracy.
I guess so.
It
is interesting.
Well, I just want to say that these people, they praise our freedom in the 30s and 40s, yet by the 50s, they're using that same freedom to undermine and destroy our nation for the culture war.
Absolutely. It is interesting to observe that in this carefully thought-out campaign, which is primarily conducted against National Socialism, no reference at all is made to Soviet Russia. Was Soviet Russia a totalitarian regime in 1938?
I thought that the Bolsheviks were popularly elected after the Tsar stepped down and told them that he thought they knew what was best, so he would just leave the country peacefully, and they let him and his family go.
That's funny, isn't it?
And everybody lived happily ever after.
If that country is mentioned, it is referred to in a friendly manner, and people are given the impression that Soviet Russia is part of the democratic group of nations. This is an outsider in 1939, right? And he's exactly right, of course. Thanks to astute propaganda, public sympathy in the United States is entirely on the side of the communists in Spain. Side by side with this pro-communist propaganda, an artificial war panic is created. The American people are told that peace in Europe is hanging only by a slim thread and that war is inevitable. No effort is spared to impress upon the American mind that in the event of a world war, the United States must take an active part in a struggle for freedom and democracy. President Roosevelt was the first in the field to give expression to this hatred of fascism. He had a twofold purpose in mind. Firstly, he wanted to divert American public opinion from difficult and complicated domestic problems. Yes, the Jews stopped the credit, especially the problem of the struggle between capital and labor. Secondly, by creating a war panic and inventing rumors about threats to Europe, he wanted to induce Americans to endorse his huge program of armaments. A program which far exceeds the United States defense requirements. Regarding the first point, it must be said that the internal situation here on the labor front is growing steadily worse. The unemployed today already number 12 million. Federal and state expenditures are increasing daily. Only these huge sums running into billions, which the U.S. Treasury expends for emergency labor projects, are keeping a certain amount of peace in the country. Is that not our exact economic climate today?
Well, how can they do this indefinitely?
Well, they can't, so we need another war. Thus far, only the usual strikes and local unrest have taken place, unless they're planning on gutting the country, I'm sorry. As to how long this artificial governmental aid can be kept up, it is difficult to predict at present. The unhappiness and growing indignation of public opinion, coupled with the serious conflict between private enterprise and the enormous trusts on one hand, and with a radicalized labor movement on the other, have made many enemies for Roosevelt and are no doubt causing him many sleepless nights. As to the second point, I can only say that President Roosevelt is a skillful expert in domestic politics and a connoisseur of the American mentality, which he has effectively turned public attention away from internal domestic problems and focused it on foreign policy. His means of achieving the effective distraction was simple. He needed, on the one hand, to highlight a fictional war menace threatening the world because of Chancellor Hitler, and on the other hand, to create a specter of war and invasion by speaking ominously about an attack of the totalitarian states on the United States. The Munich Pact came to President Roosevelt as a godsend. He described it as the capitulation of France and England to growing and aggressive German militarism. As was said here, Hitler compelled Chamberlain at pistol point. Hence, France and England had no choice but to back down and were compelled to conclude a shameful peace. Furthermore, the brutal treatment meted out to the Jews in Germany, as well as the problem of the large number of Jewish and anti-German refugees flooding this country, are both factors which intensify the existing hatred of everything connected with German National Socialism. Now, if the Jews were being treated cruelly in Germany and they were fleeing because we have refugees on the other end, right? It doesn't sound like they were being hauled off to concentration camps in electric trains, does it?
Well, if your goal is to kill people, you don't let them leave.
Right.
And you don't let them leave with all their belongings either.
In this campaign of hatred, what we see even Pataki has basically bought the whole Jewish line about separation being hatred, I guess, right? In this campaign of hatred, individual Jewish intellectuals such as Bernard Baruch, Lehman, the governor of New York State, Felix Frankfurter, the newly appointed Supreme Court judge, both of them are Jews, Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, who's a Jew, the other well-known personal friends have taken a prominent part, meaning in Roosevelt's influence, right? All of them want the president to become the protagonist of human liberty, religious freedom, and the right of free speech, and be the man who, in the future, will punish troublemongers, especially those who were not liked by Jews. This particular group of people, who are all in highly placed official American positions and who are desirous of being representatives of, quote-unquote, true Americanism and seen as champions of democracy are, in point of fact, linked with international Jewry by ties incapable of being torn asunder. And we see the same situation in our nation today, where very many of our government officials, and I actually received a list of these a couple of days ago, are dual citizens of Israel. And Pataki realized that the ties of Jews to the international Jewish community are ties that are incapable of being torn asunder. Jews will always identify themselves as Jews and act in the interest of Jews. They'll never act in the interest of their host country unless that host country has interests which are the interests of Jews.
For their own personal interests. I think sometimes Jews will betray their collective interest to advance their own personal.
Well, right. If the Rothschilds can grow rich, they'll screw every other Jew in Europe. We've seen that with the Bolshevik Revolution, haven't we?
Absolutely.
For this Jewish international, so intimately concerned with the interest of its own race, President Roosevelt's ideal role, he puts quote marks around ideal, as a champion of human rights was indeed a godsend. In this way, they are not only able to establish a dangerous center of hatred and enmity in this hemisphere, but also have succeeded in dividing the world into two warlike camps. The whole problem is being worked out in the most mysterious manner. Roosevelt has been given the power to enable him to energize the American foreign policy and at the same time create huge reserves and armaments for a future war which the Jews are deliberately heading for. With regard to domestic policy, it is extremely convenient to divert public attention from anti-Semitism, which is on the increase in the United States, by talking about the necessity of defending religious faith and individual liberty against the assault of fascism. So as soon as we defended the Jewish religious faith and individual liberty, they assaulted ours, didn't they?
Isn't that what they always have done?
Throughout the 50s and 60s. And unto this very day, the Jews have been assaulting our Christian religious freedoms, haven't they?
Isn't that what they do? They repay the Christian for his charity and generosity by defaming and blaspheming Christ and spitting in the face of the preacher.
Absolutely. The next report, this is Douglas's words now. The next report is under the date of April 30th, 1939, which Pataki wrote immediately following a private meeting in his residence with General Edwin M., nicknamed Pa, Watson, an aide and confidant of the American president. 2 days earlier, on April 28th, Adolf Hitler had delivered a scathing and sarcastic address to the German Reichstag in answer to an April 14th public appeal by Roosevelt to Hitler to guarantee the integrity of a number of countries, including Ireland, Syria, and Palestine, which was then occupied by the British. This approach to Hitler was designed solely to appeal to the public in America. Because it contained so many factual and political blunders, Hitler was able to very effectively heap ridicule on both its contents and its author. It was after the speech that General Watson came, at Roosevelt's request, to have a private discussion with the Polish ambassador. And here's his report. To the foreign minister in Warsaw. This evening, I received in my private residence General Watson, a close confidant of the American president. The general stated he was acting on the instructions of the president and wished me to convey the content of his information to the Polish government in Warsaw. It appears that Chancellor Hitler's speech in Berlin of April 28th has infuriated the president, who, the general assures me, believes that Chancellor Hitler has held him up to public ridicule and contempt. These were the exact words used by General Watson. It was also stated that because the president's family, on both his mother's and father's sides, has Jewish blood, the president has additional reasons for hating Chancellor Hitler and the Germans. So the Polish ambassador understood that Roosevelt was a Jew on both sides of his family. The president was apparently surprised and most disturbed by the visit by the German foreign minister von Ribbentrop to Warsaw in January of this year. The president is aware that the Germans were, and still are, seeking to persuade Poland to join the Anti-Comintern Pact, and I assured the general that Poland, while not well disposed to the French, refused to ally themselves with Chancellor Hitler. The general went on to state that President Roosevelt felt that Chancellor Hitler must be stopped before he began another war and before he mistreated and expelled all the Jews in Germany.
Hmm.
That's what this is about.
Can I briefly
Roosevelt's
read a list
policy
of
was to keep the Jews in Germany. Yes, go ahead.
Would it be all right for me to briefly read a list of some of Roosevelt's top advisors?
Fine.
Bernard Baruch, financier and key monetary advisor. Here's one. Felix Frankfurter, Supreme Court Justice, who played a key role in his New Deal system and gave him legal advice. David Lilienthal, a director of the Tennessee Valley Authority and a labor advisor. David Niles, presidential aide. Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice appointed by Rosenfeld, and he was also a chief proponent of the New Deal. Samuel Rosenman, the official speechwriter for FDR. Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury. Benjamin Cohen, State Department official and foreign policy advisor to FDR. Rabbi Stephen Weiss, spokesman for the American Zionist Movement, head of the American Jewish Congress, close personal friend and advisor to Rosenfeld. Francis Perkins, Secretary of Labor, allegedly Jewish, but he denied it. Sidney Hillman, advisor. Anna Rosenberg, labor advisor for FDR, manpower advisor with the Manpower Consulting Committee. Herbert Lehman, he was the governor of New York for over a decade, and then he was the director of the U.S. Office of Foreign Relief and Rehabilitation Operations with the State Department and a close friend and advisor to Rosenfeld. And the list just goes on from there. There's, of course, Benjamin Cardozo, Leo Wollmann, Rose Schneiderman, Jerome Frank, Lucien Koch, Nathan Strauss, housing advisor, Harold Glasser, Treasury Department director. I mean, it'd be quicker and easier if I just came up with a list of who in his government was actually white, you know, who wasn't a Jew. And of course here, the New Deal art administrator, Lincoln Rothschild. So of course there's a Rothschild in the woodpile there too.
Well, Joe McCarthy was right. The general went on to state that President Roosevelt felt that Chancellor Hitler must be stopped before he began another war and before he mistreated and expelled all the Jews in Germany. That's what their real concern was, that the Jews wouldn't be able to loot and pillage Germany anymore. The general especially mentioned Polish Jews in this light. There are very strong sentiments in the United States against becoming involved in another European war. And the American president must find another way to fan the flames of war in Europe. It appears from my questions to General Watson that President Roosevelt has very little actual knowledge of conditions in Europe and is acting out of a spirit of vengeance alone. And I would bet even the things Roosevelt knew or thought he knew were mostly propaganda and situations which were exaggerated by the Jews, right?
Or
by his Jewish advisors. President Roosevelt, his aide asserted, wishes the Polish government to firmly resist any attempts on the part of Chancellor Hitler to arrive at a negotiated settlement over the question of Danzig and to stand firm. I was able to assure the general that the Polish government has no intentions of bowing to pressure from Chancellor Hitler in this matter and would not yield an inch concerning Polish control over former German territories. The general stated that the president was aware of our attitudes and made a very strong suggestion that the Polish government fights fire with fire, to quote directly, and openly defy Chancellor Hitler. The president has knowledge of groups of prominent Germans, many in high military and governmental offices, who were completely opposed to Chancellor Hitler and National Socialism, and who would rise up against their regime at outbreak of a war. And I hope we get to discuss some of the generals who betrayed or disliked Hitler later on in this series, right? General Watson, furthermore, has shown me a copy of a draft treaty with the Soviet Union in which it is set forth that the Soviet Army will join with the Polish Army in attacking the Germans at the slightest provocation. The president has further suggested that such a provocation could easily be supplied by the Polish government, and the ensuing aggression of the German forces would be countered by the bravery of the Polish forces and the might of the Soviet Union. I attempted to explain to the general that the Polish government was certainly not friendly with that of the Soviet Union and, in fact, viewed them as dangerous potential enemies, not allies. I also pointed out that the Soviets had invaded Polish territory in 1920 with a view to totally resubjugate the newly formed Polish state. The general had no knowledge of the Battle for Warsaw in 1920, a battle in which this author certainly played a serious part, meaning Count Pataki. The general spoke warmly about the Soviet Union, assuring me that Stalin would have no territorial demands on the Polish state after a military defeat of the Germans and would immediately retire back behind their doors. That's incredible, right? And how could an American general promise that to a Polish ambassador?
Who was this general? Was he some Jew? What did he have in the woodpile?
Well, right. It's just a blatant lie. How could he make that promise? And that promise is absolutely contrary to all of Stalin's vocalized and public wishes.
Well, why did the Poles believe him?
Well, right. That's a good question, too. Why did the Poles believe him?
Wait, General Watson, are we sure he was an American general? When I Googled General Watson, the first one I got was Major General Sir David Watson, a Canadian general. Oh, it couldn't have been him. He was dead. Okay. So it had to be a different General Watson. Okay.
Well, this was Pa Watson, right? And I read his first name. It was Edmund,
oh.
I think.
Okay, yeah, Edwin.
Edwin Watson, yes.
Yes, I found him. Looks like he was a top Roosevelt aide. He traveled to Yalta. He was there with Stalin and Churchill. He was basically a diplomat, it looks like, in addition to being a general. So he had to be on the know. He had to know a lot of what was really going on in the Soviet Union.
Well, yes, Pataki had said he was a close aide of Roosevelt.
Well,
a general for one power can't make a promise for the intentions of another.
No.
It would be a blatant lie.
Well, yeah, if he went to the Yalta conference, then he must have known exactly how the war was going to end.
Well, right, but right here, this is 6 years before Yalta, right?
But, I mean, if he was trusted enough that they took him to Yalta, he clearly knew what was going on years ahead of time, too. He was at Tehran. It seems he was at every conference. I'm sure he would have been at Potsdam, too, had he lived, but he died in February of 45, it looks like.
Well, I think that a Pharisee would qualify this statement, right? The Soviet Union didn't have any territorial demands on the Polish state. They just took the state. I mean, if you want to think about this in terms of Jewish double talk, that's the way I would look at it.
So the Soviet Union has no territorial demands on Poland. They're just taking all of Poland.
Well, basically, that's what it boils down to, right? Poland could stay intact, but it's ours.
It's now a province of the Soviet bloc.
The president seems to be woefully lacking in any knowledge of the situation in Poland, and one should note further that the Polish embassy here has received no information about any such potential treaty between the Soviets and Americans. Although the general had with him a transcribed copy of this treaty, it was a draft only and had no identifying signatures of any kind. This appears to this writer as a mere bluff on the part of the American president, and as it was completely impossible, and so Pataki did see through it, right? And as it was completely impossible to have an informed discussion with his communicant, the general was advised that his message would be passed to the minister at once. It does appear that despite of the American president coupled with his ambition to remain in office is a very dangerous business, and his devious meddling in matters he does not understand could lead to very serious consequences, not for the United States, which would profit from a European war, but for all Europe, signed Jerzy Pataki, ambassador of the Republic of Poland. Here's a note from Douglas, the presenter of this information. Author's note, Roosevelt was rebuffed by the Poles, who later refused passage to the Soviet army when the British sought a treaty with Stalin before the outbreak of the war. It was Hitler, not Roosevelt, who signed a treaty with Stalin's Russia. And we saw last week from Suvorov that Stalin actually signed a treaty with Hitler in order to disarm him, right, basically. In a later attempt to involve the United States in the European war, Roosevelt produced what he claimed was a German plan to invade South America and later the United States. This was highly suspect at the time of its appearance and now is freely acknowledged to be a fraudulent document prepared at Roosevelt's request.
Sounds like the Zimmerman note from World War I.
Well, they play the same tricks over and over again, don't they? Hitler's response to Roosevelt was certainly one of his best speeches and deserves to be fully translated into English for the benefit of historians who appear to be oblivious to its impact. It obviously had a serious effect on Roosevelt's ego and led him to a clumsy and extremely irresponsible attempt at involving Poland, Germany, and the Soviet Union in a war. This would have been another war of Jenkins' ear with a petty motive, but with devastating consequences. There are two additional Pataki documents, one dealing with an interview with William C. Bullitt, U.S. ambassador to France, and another that was an analysis of the pro-Soviet circle that surrounded and influenced Roosevelt and encouraged his descent into a war that would only benefit Joseph Stalin.
Well,
the Polish foreign minister, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say, I think that a largely mainstream publication like the Barnes Review will say that Roosevelt is going to war over this petty insult that Hitler may or may not have made in a speech, but of course we know more than that.
Absolutely.
That would have just been a catalyst to him. That would have just been icing on the cake. How dare Hitler insult my Jewish heritage? I'm President Franklin Roosevelt. No one can say that about me. But he'd already been defined, of course, by that point.
That's how Jews usually react to such a rebuff, right? The Polish foreign ministry documents have long upset pro-Roosevelt historians and are not contained in works about the outbreak of the Second World War or the foreign policy activities of Roosevelt. However, Pataki and other diplomats whose reports appeared in a German white paper have fully authenticated all of their dispatches, only some of which appeared in the official German document. So that's a good insight into the mind of Roosevelt and into the ego of Roosevelt and how it was bruised. And Pataki believed Roosevelt to be a Jew on both sides of his family, which surely explains to me why he was put into the position that he was in the first place, because the Jews needed to destroy fascism in Europe. Fascism in Europe was a direct affront to Jewish capitalism in Europe, and it was the debate and the struggle between fascism and capitalism in Europe was the struggle for whether the Jews were going to control the future of Europe. And we see that in human terms. In godly terms, I mean in the Revelation, chapter 17, verse 17, we couldn't help it. Our kingdom was to be handed over to the beast, and the Jews are this beast.
Absolutely, there's no doubt.
So fascism was doomed to fail, but fascism was the white man's last stance against the control of the beast in this modern world. And simply because Yahweh decreed our punishment, that doesn't mean that we have to like it, right? I mean, most of us don't like it.
The Jews see fascism as a threat, and rightly so, because fascism is the white man's attempt to keep the white man's land for himself and to keep it out of the hands of the Jew.
Well, absolutely. Hitler's economic plan, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a system where people pool their assets to produce goods and sell the goods hoping for a profit. I don't see a problem with that. I don't see a biblical problem with that. Okay, it's done in ancient times all the time. But usury is evil, and the Jews insist on producing every dollar into our economies with a demand of usury. So the debt can never be paid. Because if every dollar that's produced into an economy automatically demands a percentage of interest back, then there is always a debt outstanding which every dollar in the economy could not pay. It's impossible. It's a satanic scheme.
We need more money than there is money in circulation.
Yes, we do. It's a satanic scheme. Now, another thing that capitalism does is it drains the creative powers of a nation or a community, and it moves them out of the community, where fascism makes sure that the intellectual property of a community is maintained by the community. In other words, we don't invent supercomputers and just give them to the Chinese so that they could build them for us. Fascism would prevent that. Hitler's system prevented that. Fascism is a protection against that. Capitalism is the raping, loot, and pillage of the intellectual property and the resources of the world for the benefit of the person who provided the capital.
Absolutely. So we will pick up then next week on the Hitler series. Correct?
Yes, I would like to talk more about the military struggle between, and John, you'll be able to contribute more than I in this aspect of it, that the much more I imagine the military struggle and between the Germans and the Soviets, and how far the great disadvantage that the Germans had in a war that they just had to fight.
Oh yeah. It's about the replacement of their losses was practically impossible compared to the Soviets.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, praise Yahweh.
Thank you. Yahweh bless.
All right.